So whereas the previous three books have been intensely yogic in a kind of didactic way, but also in a mantric way, with an intention to change one's perception and one's orientation to existence with sacrifice and the dualities and the powers of manifestation being imposed upon the mind by the imagery. In these two books, we see very transparently the epic structure coming to the front. And because of that, it's possible to give a more literary interpretation to these books, which we will do tonight. So, for example, if you think about the definition of allegory, which is this: any form of imaginative literature or spoken utterance, especially myth, constructed in such a way that readers or listeners are encouraged to look for meanings hidden beneath the surface. That's the meaning of allegory. And the great mythical literature, Homer's Odyssey and Virgil's Aeneid, and Vyasa's Mahabharata, are prime examples of allegory in that sense. It's a symbolic language that is meant to encourage the hearer to look for hidden meanings, because the meaning couldn't possibly be what's being said on the surface. So, literature that elicits a searching interpretation leads to what is known as the hermeneutic process. The hermeneutic process is the process of interpreting what's being said or read for the sake of understanding its intended meaning. That's the hermeneutic process. It's a philosophical, linguistic approach to literature or to scripture. It comes mostly from study of scripture, but it's also applied to literature in general. The interpretation of the meaning of the literary structure, that's hermeneutic process. So, hermeneutic. It's a Greek word. Aristotle wrote a chapter titled The Hermeneutics about literature. I mean, how do we understand how does literature affect us psychologically? What are the structures of literature that cause us to want to improve ourselves?
So it's not interpretation of the text itself, but how it's related to our understanding.
It's interpretation of the meaning of the text in order to disengage from the structure the meaning. So particularly with respect to mythical poetry, it is structured by the poet in such a way that it contains in it the highest values of the culture. But in order to understand those values, it's necessary to disengage the meaning from the structure. And that's what the mind does. So I was giving a talk to students the other day about the Ramayana and the story of Rama in the forest with Sita, and he draws a circle, and she's not supposed to go out of it, and Lakshman is supposed to protect her. And so here you have higher mind, soul. It's actually one person, it's not three. Rama, Lakshman, and Sita are one being. And when the loyal protector, mind, doesn't do its job, and then the soul chases after the golden deer, the magical illusion, and gets lost in the forest and abducted by evil. And because the Vishnu had come to establish Dharma, and therefore the mind and vital and psychic being all get disorganized and have to be reorganized by the process of the movement of the drama and rescue from evil. And the vital forces, Hanuman, have to be organized, and the mental forces have to be organized, and eventually in the end the soul is reorganized, everything is reorganized around the rescued, liberated soul. So this is the Indian value system is embodied in that myth. But it's if you look at it as a trip into the forest, you know, by a couple of good-looking guys and a nice chick named Sita, and they get lost in the forest, and then, you know, some evil spirit comes along and captures her. That's nonsense. That's not what it's about. So, the allegorical mode, in the allegorical mode, well, let's say another definition. The allegorical mode is controlled indirectness and double meaning. That's the definition of the allegorical mode. Controlled, structured, poetic indirectness and double meaning. Yeah, highly symbolic. But everything is symbolic. So it's not just metaphor, but it is metaphor used to convey a structure of values through a structure of myth. The living values and the structure of myth. So if you were going to be serious students of literature and wanted to apply these principles, you could go back through the three books that we've already covered and do an allegorical interpretation, which I do, but not in a very systematic way as we are going along. Because what Sri Aurobindo brings to this epic allegorical structure is the mantric force, the mantric element. And so there's an added intention. His intention is not just to reinforce socio-cultural values. His intention is to convey energy that transforms consciousness. But we won't be seeing that so much. So we will be seeing these other things, and I'll just read some lines from these seven books, maybe, if we can get that far. And in the back of the understanding and search for meaning, we can appreciate the fact that this is an allegorical structure, and you can disengage from it its meaning. And that is the intention of the author. He happens to have been an expert in this area. So the first passage in this book recalls an essential spiritual duality that has been maintained throughout, and it's exceptionally beautiful, I think, just to hear it and to realize that this is something else. A maenad of the cycles of desire around a light she must not dare to touch, hastening towards a far-off unknown goal, Earth followed the endless journey of the sun. A mind but half awake in the swing of the void, on the bosom of inconscience, dreamed out life and bore this finite world of thought and deed across the immobile trance of the infinite. The immobile trance of the infinite, the void, is the ever-present background of the revolution of the earth around the sun and of all the movements of life. The movements of life cannot exist without that immobile void presence in which things move.
Yeah, interesting. Earth follows and the journey of the sun. The sun is first and Earth goes behind the sun.
Right. Well, this is symbolic. But it's also the reality of existence. So it's not only allegorical. This is Sri Aurobindo's vision in a compact image that has the power to alter our perception of things. Because he repeats this image all the time, on every page, polarity of the void and the creative energy. They are complementary. A vast, immutable silence with her ran. Prisoner of speed upon a jeweled wheel, she communed with the mystic heart in space. The mystic heart in space. There is an ever-present psychic being that is empty and luminous behind everything. Amid the ambiguous stillness of the stars. It's an ambiguous stillness because they are moving very rapidly and yet they are stationary in relation to various other points of perception. This world is an illusion. Amid the ambiguous stillness of the stars, she moved towards some undisclosed event, and her rhythm measured the long whirl of time. In ceaseless motion round the purple rim, day after day sped by like colored spokes And through a glamour of shifting hues of air, the seasons drew in linked significant dance the symbol pageant of the changing year. So it's an image of motion and stillness, perfectly counterpoised. Time and not time. Then there follows a long and powerful description of the monsoon season, which I'm not going to read. But you know, you can see these images of the monsoon. There's summer and then there's monsoon, and it's, you know, you can imagine Sri Aurobindo sitting in his room year after year, listening and watching the clouds and the rain, and just capturing that monsoon atmosphere perfectly. And then, of course, follows spring. And here is where we can begin to capture something that is of literary excellence and symbolizes the whole of this epic. Then spring, an ardent lover leaped through leaves and caught the earth bride in his eager clasp. His coming brought the magic and the spell. At his touch, life's tired heart grew glad and young. Here's a good example of quantitative meter on which every line is based. At his touch, first foot, life's tired heart, second foot, grew glad and young, third and fourth foot. He made joy a willing prisoner in her breast. 3 feet. 4 feet, 3 feet. That's the basic quantitative metric structure that is followed throughout. So when you read Savitri rhythmically, you will hear this quantitative meter. And it is extremely powerful. And what happens when you're reading it is that your articulation shifts from the mouth to the throat. And it doesn't matter anymore how you form the words with your tongue and your lips. Everything begins to come from the throat center. And then you can just surrender your reading to that pulsation from the throat center, and your voice, which is closely associated with thought, and your eyes, which are closely associated with the word, suddenly shut off and tune in to the sound. And the sound alone carries all the meaning. So then you can read 5 or 10 pages that are just pulsating from the throat center and allow your mind to see everything which is being said. And there's no oral interpretation and there's no visual interpretation. This is essential for Savitri. What?
You told us secret today.
Yes, that's a secret. And this past summer, I actually initiated somebody into it who had a marvelous voice, and he tuned right into it, and it became just extraordinary, the quality of sound that started to come out when he was not thinking with his mouth and his eyes, you know. Anyway, then I wanted to get to this. At his touch, life's tired heart grew glad and young. He made joy a willing prisoner in her breast. His grasp was a young god's upon earth's limbs. Changed by the passion of his divine outbreak, he made her body beautiful with his kiss. He made her body beautiful with his kiss. This is Sri Aurobindo, the lover, speaking, not the overmind guru. So we're following the seasons here, and I'm going on over to... These classic lines, which everyone has read, introduce a section that is describing Savitri, but all of its images are exactly parallel to the description of Aswapati in the first pages of Book 3. You will recognize all of them. So this is the recapitulation in Savitri of everything that Aswapati was and is. In this high signal moment of the gods, answering Earth's yearning and her cry for bliss, a greatness from our other countries came. A silence in the noise of earthly things immutably revealed the secret word. The silence and the word. There must be, I don't know how many, a dozen different lines in Savitri where she is described as the silence and the word. That is Savitri. That descent of silence and that illumining word, that's what Sri Aurobindo invoked from the mother at the end of the vision and the boon, and she acceded to send to earth an emanation of herself which would lead us to the transformation. And that the essence of that emanation is the silence, that special one that we mentioned before, which is not just silence, it's absolute silence. And the word, which is not just poetry and it's not just scripture, it's mantra. It is the illumining word, the absolute ray of truth that strikes us with the full meaning of existence. Here, word doesn't mean phoneme and morpheme and syntax. It means seeing, speech, thought, truth, power, essence, all together. A silence in the noise of earthly things immutably revealed the secret word. A mightier influx filled the oblivious clay. This is about descent, the descent of Shakti. A mightier influx filled the oblivious clay. This is Sri Aurobindo's constant mantra, the mantra of the descent of the divine Shakti, how it feels, how it looks, what it does to us. A lamp was lit, a sacred image made, a mediating ray had touched the earth, bridging the gulf between man's mind and God's. That's what she does when she descends. And then our mind is all of that higher mind luminosity. Its brightness linked our transience to the unknown. A spirit of its celestial source aware, translating heaven into a human shape, descended into earth's imperfect mold and wept not, fallen to mortality, but looked on all with large and tranquil eyes. One had returned from the transcendent plains and bore anew the load of mortal breath, who had striven of old with our darkness and our pain. She took again her divine unfinished task. Survivor of death and the aeonic years, once more with her fathomless heart, she fronted time. So we remember that Savitri is the original divine word that descended in the very beginning of existence, right? And then again she descended to ignite life in dumb matter. And now again she descends to awaken the evolution of the higher mind and the supermind. This is the beginning of the Epic of Savitri, book, page 353. That's where it begins. So that's the mythic. You see, now here we can see the allegory clearly. This is the mythic structure, the divine goddess silence and word descends, filling the human clay, the human mold with light, and reconnecting the human mind to the transcendent source. That's the mythic structure. Now, we can extract from that the meaning that this is the yoga of Sri Aurobindo and the Mother, which we recapitulate in ourselves in order to transform life and mind. We invoke that word, that truth consciousness, or whatever we want to call it. We surrender to it. It descends in us, and our consciousness becomes this cosmic consciousness, and then she is in us. Just like for Aswapati, the mother descended in him, and then he was what he was because of her in him. And so all of existence is marked by that pattern, and that's a cosmological symbol. But for us, it's an actual experience that brings another vibration into our consciousness. And that we base our life upon. We base our values, our value system, and the meaning of our lives on that.
Why do we do that? Why do we do this?
Well, we do it because it feels good.
Yes.
Well, it sometimes it hurts, but then it feels good afterwards. Like so many things. I can see we're not going to get through all of this tonight. there's too much of it. Anyway, I just wanted to pick up another set of lines from this page. To reinforce the mythic structure and the yogic process, starting here. Once more, that will put on an earthly shape, a mind empowered from truth's immutable seat was framed for vision and interpreting act, and instruments were sovereignly designed to express divinity in terrestrial signs. Words, symbols, outlined by the pressure of this new descent, a lovelier body formed than earth had known. The pressure forms the beauty of the body, and in this case takes on a body itself, fully, mythically. As yet a prophecy only and a hint, the glowing arc of a charmed unseen whole, it came into the sky of mortal life, bright like the crescent horn of a gold moon, returning in a faint illumined eve. At first, glimmering like an unshaped idea, passive she lay, sheltered in wordless sleep, involved and drowned in matter's giant trance, an infant heart of the deep-caved world plan. So she's not yet manifested, but the whole power is there for that manifestation. It has descended. Some missioned power in the half-wakened frame nursed a transcendent birth's dumb, glorious seed, for which this vivid tenement was made. Now, if you know the ending of Savitri, the last book, at the end of the last book, she descends again on earth into a mother's body to reincarnate after the whole cycle of her yoga is finished. She descends again to bring immortality to the race, to the human species. Right now, it's the descent of the possibility in one person. And only after the whole arc of her yoga is complete, is she able to descend again, to take birth again. So right now, at this point, she's taking birth and becoming a body on earth, but it's not yet that, it just has that potential. But soon the link of soul with form grew sure. Flooded was the dim cave with slow, conscient light. The seed grew into a delicate, marvelous bud. The bud disclosed a great and heavenly bloom. At once she seemed to found a mightier race, Arrived upon the strange and dubious globe, the child, remembering inly a far home, lived, guarded in her spirit's luminous cell, alone mid men in her diviner kind. In her childish... Sorry, I lost. Even in her childish movements could be felt the nearness of a light still kept from earth, feelings that only eternity could share, thoughts natural and native to the gods. I wanted to read that passage especially for this line. At once, she seemed to found a mightier race. Then she starts to grow up. I would suggest that this canto, the structure and intention of this canto is to convey to us the meaning of the divine Shakti. The meaning of the divine Shakti. What it is. Not what we think it is or what symbolically it means, but what it really means, how it feels, how it looks, what it does, its reality. The purpose of mantric poetry, as Sri Aurobindo has explained, is to convey to the mind the inner reality of the thing itself that is being said. So I would suggest that this canto has that potential. It's about that. But it's not just about that, it is that. It is the expression of the divine Shakti, the divine force. This canto is nothing but that. So we can just bathe in a few lines of it here and see what we feel. Over her watched millennial influences and the deep godheads of a grandiose past, looked on her and saw the future's godheads come, as if this magnet drew their powers unseen. Earth's brooding wisdom spoke to her still breast. Mounting from mind's last peaks to mate with God's, making Earth's brilliant thoughts a springing board to dive into the cosmic vastnesses, the knowledge of the thinker and the seer saw the unseen and thought the unthinkable, opened the enormous doors of the unknown, rent man's horizons into infinity. A shoreless sweep was lent to the mortal's acts, and art and beauty sprang from the human depths. Nature and soul vied in nobility, ethics the human keyed to imitate heaven. The harmony of a rich culture's tones refined the sense and magnified its reach. To hear the unheard and glimpse the invisible, and taught the soul to soar beyond things known, inspiring life to greaten and break its bounds. Aspiring to the immortal's unseen world, leaving Earth's safety, daring wings of mind bore her above the trodden fields of thought, crossing the mystic seas of the beyond to live on eagle heights near to the sun. That's power. Mantra means a word of power. And this word of power is conveying a force that is can only be understood as the divine Shakti. This is not mortal force. A force that can create beauty and art and an ethical mind in the world as a whole that is reaching towards immortal heights. That's not our ordinary ethical mind or power. There, where she just sailed up to near the sun, there wisdom sits on her eternal throne. All her life's turns led her to symbol doors, admitting to secret powers that were her kin. Adept of truth, initiate of bliss, a mystic acolyte trained in nature's school, aware of the marvel of created things, she laid the secrecies of her heart's deep muse upon the altar of the wonderful. Her hours were a ritual in a timeless fane. Her acts became gestures of sacrifice. Invested with a rhythm of higher spheres, the word was used as a hieratic means for the release of the imprisoned spirit into communion with its comrade gods. The rhythms of speech are used deliberately to release, to empower. Savitri alone is able to use speech, word, to do that. And I'm not speaking about the words on the page. I'm speaking about Savitri alone, the goddess manifested on earth, the power of illumined speech. That's what she is. That's what's manifesting. We just heard it. We might even see its glow in the atmosphere. Invested with a rhythm of higher spheres, the word was used as a hieratic means for the release of the imprisoned spirit into communion with its comrade gods. Or it helped to beat out new expressive forms of that which labors in the heart of life, some immemorial soul in men and things. Seeker of the unknown and the unborn, carrying a light from the ineffable to rend the veil of the last mysteries. Intense philosophies pointed earth to heaven. Not just ordinary mental philosophies. Intense philosophies pointed earth to heaven. Or on foundations broad as cosmic space, upraised the earth mind to superhuman heights, overpassing lines that please the outward eyes, but hide the sight of that which lives within. A boundless knowledge greater than man's thought, a happiness too high for heart and sense. Locked in the world and yearning for release, she felt in her, waiting as yet for form. It asked for objects around. It asked for objects around which to grow, and natures strong to bear without recoil the splendor of her native royalty, her greatness and her sweetness and her bliss, her might to possess and her vast power to love. Earth made a stepping stone to conquer heaven. The soul saw beyond heaven's limiting boundaries, met a great light from the unknowable, and dreamed of a transcendent action sphere. Aware of the universal self in all, she turned to living hearts and human forms. Her soul's reflections, complements, counterparts, the close outlying portions of her being, divided from her by walls of body and mind, yet to her spirit bound by ties divine. Overcoming invisible hedge and masked defense, and the loneliness that separates soul from soul, she wished to make all one immense embrace, that she might house in it all living things, raised into a splendid point of seeing light, out of division's dense, inconscient cleft, and make them one with God and world and her. But she had a problem. And here is, you know, as Sri Aurobindo always does, he gives us a counterpoint of the problem that this divine Shakti has to address. And this is us. We are the problem. Only a few responded to her call. Still fewer felt the screened divinity and strove to mate its godhead with their own, approaching with some kinship to her heights. They leaped to find her in a moment's flash, glimpsing a light in a celestial vast, but could not keep the vision and the power, and fell back to life's dull, ordinary tone. A mind daring heavenly experiment. Growing towards some largeness they felt near, testing the unknown's bound with eager touch, they still were prisoned by their human grain. They could not keep up with her tireless step, too small and eager for her large-paced will, too narrow to look with the unborn infinite's gaze, their nature weary grew of things too great. For even the close partners of her thoughts, who could have walked the nearest to her ray, worshipped the power and light they felt in her, but could not match the measure of her soul. A friend, and yet too great holy to know. She walked in their front, towards a greater light, their leader and queen over their hearts and souls, one close to their bosoms, yet divine and far. Admiring and amazed, they saw her stride, attempting with a godlike rush and leap heights for their human stature too remote. So, what happens here, if we look at it as a sequence that ties together the epic structure, she finds that humanity is incapable of this change that she makes possible. Then in the next canto, we come back to Aswapati. And this is a very interesting segue, because she's born on earth now as a result of his call, but humanity is not ready. So what does Aswapati do at this point? He is the master yogi. He has brought this force to earth, and he has observed, he is observing, if we look at the mythical structure, he is observing what we just saw, the contrast between her power and the human ability. And I think there are only two or three times in the whole poem where Aswapati's name is stated. And this is one of them, and it's very significant. Because here, Sri Aurobindo steps in, if we take Aswapati as Sri Aurobindo, if we take this epic as also being autobiographical, and that's one of its unique features, it is autobiographical. Otherwise it couldn't be mantric, says Rod. Just a theoretical statement. Away from the terrestrial murmur turned, where transient calls and answers mix their flood, King Aswapati listened through the ray to other sounds than meet the sense-formed ear. On a subtle interspace which rings our life, unlocked were inner spirits, transclosed doors. Unlocked were inner spirits, transclosed doors. The inaudible strain in nature could be caught. Across this cyclic tramp of eager lives, across the deep urgency of present cares, Earth's wordless hymn to the ineffable arose from the silent heart of the cosmic void. In trance he returns to the void, where only it's possible to hear the truth. He heard the voice repressed of unborn powers murmuring behind the luminous bars of time. Time and the void, always counterposed. So at any point we can step from time back into the void. And there is the Word. Remember those lines, the Word that comes through the silence. Again, the mighty yearning raised its flame that asks a perfect life on earth for men, and prays for certainty in the uncertain mind, and shadowless bliss for suffering human hearts, and truth embodied in an ignorant world, and Godhead divinizing mortal form. That was his prayer that brought Savitri to birth in the first place. Now he goes back to that same consciousness, the consciousness which is the meaning of Savitri, the need for that force. He goes back to that primal need. A word that leaped from some far sky of thought, admitted by the cowled receiving scribe, admitted by Sri Aurobindo, the cowled receiving scribe, traversed the echoing passages of his brain and left its stamp on the recording cells. And then he speaks. This is the epic moment. The power itself is given speech. And this is what it says. O force compelled, fate driven, earth-born race, O petty adventurers in an infinite world, and prisoners of a dwarf humanity, how long will you tread the circling tracks of mind around your little self and petty things? But not for a changeless littleness were you meant. Not for vain repetition were you built. Out of the immortal substance you were made. Your actions can be swift revealing steps. Your life a changeful mold for growing gods. A seer, a strong creator is within. The immaculate grandeur broods upon your days. Almighty powers are shut in nature's cells. A greater destiny waits you in your front. This transient earthly being, if he wills, can fit his acts to a transcendent scheme. He who now stares at the world with ignorant eyes, hardly from the inconscient night aroused, that look at images and not at truth, can fill those orbs with an immortal sight. Yet shall the Godhead grow within your hearts. You shall awake into the spirit's air and feel the breaking walls of mortal mind, and feel and hear the message which left life's heart dumb. So he is seeing again the whole vision of what's possible for this petty, weak, impotent, stupid species. He's again seeing the two things in perfect correspondence and calling that word of truth into our hearing, making us hear it. Authors of Earth's high chains, to you it is given to cross the dangerous spaces of the soul and touch the mighty mother stark awake, and meet the omnipotent in this house of flesh, and make of life the million-bodied one. Then he tells Savitri that what she has to do under the circumstances is find that one person on earth ready to bear her force. And she sets out on a pilgrimage, and she visits all the meditating high spirits on earth, and she visits all the ordinary people in their realms, and she searches high and low for that one soul ready to unite with her. Is it you? Because this is pure symbolism. And Satyavan is this one ready being who is the son of the blind king, who has gone into the forest and experienced peace and tranquility, and who knows everything that we can know. But he's stepped out of the turmoil and attuned himself to all of nature and all of mankind and all of the subtle energies of existence, and made himself pure and ready. So that there can be a beginning of this union between the human soul and the incarnate divine Shakti. So that's the symbolism, that's the mythic structure. And we can perform the hermeneutic process of extracting from it the meaning of our lives. So King Ashwapati realigns himself with the whole vision and sends Savitri on her mission. You know, as he was reciting this this thing that I was just reciting, his recitation ends here. The voice withdrew into its hidden skies, but like a shining answer from the gods, approached through sun-bright spaces, Savitri. She comes to his call. She resonates with that vision. And he says to her, O Spirit, traveler of eternity, who camest from the immortal spaces here, armed for the splendid hazard of thy life, to set thy conquering foot on chance and time. O living inscription of the beauty of love, mistled in aureate virginity, what message of heavenly strength and bliss in thee is written with the eternal's sun-white script? One shall discover and greaten with it his life, to whom thou loosenest thy heart's jeweled strings. There is one waiting somewhere. And just to wind up with the idea of mantra, the idea that this Savitri force is mantric force, and that Ashwapati Sri Aurobindo does all of this with speech. Here is the proof. This word was seed of all the thing to be. A hand from some greatness opened her heart's locked doors and showed the work for which her strength was born. As when the mantra sinks in yoga's ear, its message enters, stirring the blind brain, and keeps in the dim, ignorant cells its sound. The hearer understands a form of words, and musing on the index thought it holds, he strives to read it with the laboring mind, but finds bright hints, not the embodied truth. Then, falling silent in himself to know, he meets the deeper listening of his soul. The word repeats itself in rhythmic strains. Thought, vision, feeling, sense, the body's self are seized unutterably, and he endures an ecstasy and an immortal change. He feels a wideness and becomes a power. All knowledge rushes on him like a sea. Transmuted by the white spiritual ray, he walks in naked heavens of joy and calm, sees the God face, and hears transcendent speech. An equal greatness in her life was sown. So here we get a parallel between the actual word of the yogi that empowers the spirit and a description on the following page of how the word empowers the spirit. So that's a parallel structure that is based upon double meaning. But here, the double meaning is given to us in parallel passages. This, the mythical symbolic and the actual mantric transmission. And they correspond exactly to each other. In other words, what happened just now was what happened throughout time when the word is invoked by the yogi and the message comes across to us and we resonate with it and discover in it the potential for unification with that power. And then we become silent and listen more deeply for it to settle. At some level of real meaning for us personally. So she's seeking us. The word of Savitri is the magnet that's drawing us. It's all symbolic.
Yeah.
Absolutely the same message. Mm-hmm. But here it's put into mantric speech. So we don't have to know the frames of reference, but if we do know the frames of reference, then we can easily perform the allegorical reduction, you know, which is exactly what the hermeneutic process is about. Unfortunately, the hermeneutic process often loses the spirit in the process. But it can also be a tool. It provided me with a framework for introducing the unit. Because it's true. Allegorical structure is exactly that. It's a mythic structure which conveys a power and a mystical truth that we can base our lives upon. It's not just a myth.